Tonight's speaker is an old and valued friend of the Ford Hall Forum, and I have had the pleasure of introducing him several times in the past. Dr. Leonard Peikoff is recognized around the world as the leader of the philosophical school known as Objectivism, founded by Ayn Rand, author of such books as Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. Dr. Peikoff first met Ayn Rand in 1951 when he was still a teenager, and he began a friendship and professional association that lasted until her death. In 1964, Leonard Peikoff received his doctorate in philosophy from New York University. He went on to teach philosophy at such distinguished institutions as Hunter College, Long Island University, New York University, and the University of Denver. He served as editor of Ayn Rand's last work, Philosophy, Who Needs It?, and is the author of numerous works of his own, including The Voice of Reason, published in 1989, and his upcoming volume, Objectivism, The Philosophy of Ayn Rand, which is due to be published in the fall of 1991, and which I am told he just finished last Friday. Discussing the topic philosophy and the real world out there, I am happy to present to you Dr. Leonard Peikoff.
Thank you, Jeffrey. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A few years ago, I gave a speech to the American Philosophical Association as part of a symposium entitled Philosophy and the Real World Out There. The question at issue was, is there any connection between the two, between philosophy and the real world out there? A question which eloquently reveals the current state of philosophy. My speech, I may say, was not well received by the audience, but nevertheless, I want to reiterate some points from it tonight, points I regard as important to anyone who is trying to understand modern philosophy. Then I want to give you a series of what Ayn Rand would call horror quotes, taken from the newspapers, which illustrate dramatically the relation between philosophy and the real world out there. The APA symposium began with a paper by a philosophy professor, David Glidden, from the University of California at Riverside. Professor Glidden, a linguistic analyst who belongs fully to today's philosophic mainstream, started the seminar by doing something unusual for an academic. He was honest. In other words, bluntly outspoken about the calamitous state of philosophy today. He told us that most people understandably now regard philosophers as, quote, charlatans or sophists. That the profession has sunk into what he called a new scholasticism, with philosophers having withdrawn from life, churning out articles and books unintelligible to mankind and useless even if they were decipherable. Philosophy today, he said, has no definition or unifying mission. It has degenerated into a flux of pointless cults and subspecialties. Philosophers today, he said, are often characterized by infantilism, affect disorders, and several other forms of psychopathology, which he elaborated. In short, they are mentally sick and are busy gathering around them, here's a quote from Glidden, students and new colleagues who are increasingly bizarre, unquote. If you went to the APA meetings and saw the types who hang out there, you'd know what he meant by bizarre. Philosophers, he summed up, are not a ship of fools, they are, quote, a fleet of fools who have failed the public and, in effect, wrecked philosophy itself. to all of which I say amen. Before you conclude that Professor Glidden is a voice of sanity, however, I must tell you his basic explanation of today's dire situation. Philosophers, he says, are too rational. They have overemphasized reason at the expense of feeling. The mind, says Glidden, must not be a victim of its reason. What then is the solution to philosophy's plight? To what should we subordinate reason? Quote from his last page, compassion and community involvement, unquote. In other words, philosophers are cut off from the real world out there because they think too much. And the way to regain contact with reality is through some version of mindless love and social activism. Now, I don't regard this diagnosis as worthy of refutation. It's senseless on its face. A philosophy that overemphasizes reason is an impossibility. Such a thing is a contradiction in terms. It would be like a geometry that overemphasized reason. Or to change the analogy, it would be like a symphony that was too involved with sound. In my view, the problem with philosophers is not that they are too enamored of reason, but that they long ago discarded it. There's a parallel here to politics. Just as the United States abandoned capitalism many decades ago, yet capitalism is still being blamed for all our social ills, even though they come from the opposite of capitalism, from government intervention, so philosophers rejected reason centuries ago, but still blame it for all their intellectual ills, even though these come from the very opposite of reason. How and when did philosophers reject reason? To understand the state of philosophy today, we must review the main stages it has gone through to reach its modern climax. Nothing less will explain why our professors now hold debates as to whether they have any connection with the real world out there. There are four main stages of development here, recognized in all the textbooks: the Greeks, the medievals, the early moderns, which is basically the 17th and 18th century, and the Kantians, which is the last two centuries. Bear with me as I outline for you briefly the essence of each of these periods as I see it. And first, the Greeks. That, of course, is a tradition to which Ayn Rand and objectivism belongs philosophically. Most of the Greeks took reality properly as an axiom and an absolute, especially the Aristotelians. And by reality, they meant the world out there, the external physical world, the world of nature, this world in which we live. Reality, they agreed, is knowable by man entirely on his own, by the senses and reason, by observation and logic. In ethics, as a result, they held that the good is knowable by reason, that rational value judgments are possible which can guide man in action and lead him to happiness on earth. Now, this was the best period in the history of thought. It's been downhill ever since. The medievals, the second, turned the focus of thought to religion. Their primary interest was not in the physical world, not in nature, but in the supernatural, and therefore not in reason or rational ethics, but in revelations, dogmas, commandments supposedly emanating from God. But note that the medievals, like the Greeks, were still completely oriented around the concept of reality. They too regarded that concept, the concept of reality, as an axiom, an absolute, an essential of philosophy. Their difference with the Greeks lies in the question, what is reality? Or better still, where is reality? Reality was no longer identified with this world, but with the next. Reality was not out there, but up there. Now the early moderns, from about Descartes on. In essence, the moderns gradually dropped religion. They wanted to come back to the realm of nature. They wanted to believe that an external world exists, as the Greeks had said. But they couldn't find the world, so they claimed. When, for example, they had a sensory perception, they said, It wasn't reality they were seeing or hearing, but only an experience in their own minds. So they were cut off from the outside altogether. They were locked within their own consciousness. And the result was these philosophers turned philosophy inwards. The only reality they could find is consciousness, the self, the mind. And you see, that's basically the last possibility left. Out there, up there, what's left? In here, and that's it. Now, this approach led the moderns straight to skepticism. If you can never get outside your own mind, then you can't tell the difference between fact and illusion, truth and falsehood, dream and reality. Now, these philosophers tried to answer skepticism, but as David Hume showed abundantly, they couldn't do it. They couldn't explain how reason operated or how it could know reality. Now, this is the point at which Kant entered the scene with his Copernican revolution, as he called it. And the essence of his revolution, now these are my words, was, we've tried every other option and failed. There's only one hope left. Let's get rid of reality altogether. Reality, any version of it, is passé. Let's not be restrained by the concept any longer. Now, of course, Kant himself stated this conclusion in hundreds of pages with many qualifications and cover-ups, but that is his essential meaning, as I take it. Kant divorced man from reality in any of the three earlier versions. Whenever we perceive or think, he said, we process the material from reality by our subjective mental structure. We automatically impose our own innate ideas or categories on the object. So we never come into contact with any real object, only with what he called the phenomenal object. In other words, the object we ourselves create by our processing. Our mind, therefore, is detached from any kind of reality. Out there, up there, in here. We cannot know things in themselves. So the Greek approach is out. If there is an external world, it's a painful choice, but I've made it myself. Yeah. If there is an external world, it is unknowable. Similarly, we can't know God, and we cannot even know ourselves, our own minds. When we introspect, Kant held, we don't grasp ourself as it really is in itself, but only as it appears to us. Reality, therefore, is utterly unknowable. From which Kant's followers quickly concluded, the whole idea then is a myth. There's no such thing. There's only the world of phenomena. Only the subjective world of our own making, which, the Kantians added, we can alter as we like. After all, what we human beings create, we can wipe out or change as we choose. Now, the next step taken by the Kantians. If there is no reality, then there is nothing to limit or constrain us in coming to conclusions. There's nothing for us to look to for guidance or direction in using our minds. There's nothing below or above, without or within. It's completely deuces wild. If you say, well, but shouldn't we still follow logic, for example? Their answer would be, logic is a game we play. It's a human game with arbitrary rules like chess. After all, there's no reality behind logic. Reality is out. So why should I accept your logic? Or if I accept it today, why tomorrow if I feel differently? In other words, the corollary of no reality is no objective truth, no absolutes, no knowledge. Kant was the most thorough skeptic in history, meaning by skeptic one who holds that knowledge of reality by the use of reason is impossible. There were many skeptics before Kant, but none like him. Before him, skepticism had always been rejected like the plague. It had been equated with futility, despair, a dead end. So philosophers always tried to fight the skeptics off and answer them. Kant was the first complacent skeptic. Skepticism, he said, is not a dead end, it's a vital new beginning. So long as we struggle to know reality, any reality, he said, we're going to fail. But if we once take the bull by the horns and grasp that we don't need reality, that whatever so-called facts we need, we can create ourselves, then we are home free. We're in charge of the universe, the phenomenal universe. Our minds, in effect, have the unlimited power that God used to in the old days, so we can do what we want with no obstacles and no holds barred. In other words, we don't know reality, but this is not paralyzing, it's liberating. That is the Kantian revolution that made skepticism endure for two centuries, right up to our time. Now, so much for a crash course in Kant. I think you can see that Kant's thought is, in the words of one author sympathetic to his ideas, a, quote, stunning upheaval in Western thought. The title of this gentleman's book, by the way, is perfect for the Kantian age. His book is called Reality Isn't What It Used to Be. And now you can see why philosophers aren't what they used to be either. Specifically, why the field is ruled by what Glidden calls a new scholasticism. Neither the Greeks nor the early moderns were scholastics, in the sense of being locked in an ivory tower, out of touch with mankind, writing technical tracts only for other philosophers, making senseless, minute distinctions as an end in itself. Both these periods, the Greek and the early modern, were committed to life on earth. Both believed, the Greeks confidently, the early moderns at least as a hope for the future. Both believed that this world can be known and that such knowledge will provide the solution to all man's problems. But the medievals were scholastics because they scorned this world as unreal and worldly problems as unimportant. To the medievals, withdrawal into an ivory tower or cloister concerned only with God seemed fitting, even obligatory. A Kantian age repeats the medieval spectacle, though from a different cause. Kantians, too, turn away from the world and the problems of men, not in the name of God, but of skepticism. In their view, there is no world for philosophy to know, and there are no answers to the questions living men ask. Again, therefore, the turning in of philosophers on themselves comes to seem obligatory. The medieval scholastics at least had a mission and a passion springing from their allegiance to God. Our modern scholastics, however, have no allegiances. Skeptics are unable to uphold any fundamental value or idea, not even skepticism. Indeed, I'm sure you have all witnessed staunch professorial skeptics delightedly insisting that certainty is possible in order to confound another skeptic for the moment and thereby reaffirm the nihilist proposition that no one can know anything, including that proposition itself. Men who pursue a career detached from reality and from convictions have to end up as the pathological types described by Professor Glidden. A higher type of man would not sail in the fleet of fools and probably couldn't get a job in one of its canoes even if he tried. Philosophers have given up the world. They have given up reality. They write unintelligible gibberish in unreadable journals for the initiates only. Does this mean that philosophy, therefore, has no influence on the world anymore? Unfortunately, no. Philosophers shape the world even when they withdraw from it. They shape it through their fundamental ideas, which cannot be disguised or concealed. Just as the medieval shaped men's culture and politics, even as they officially turned away from all such worldly endeavors. Man needs philosophy. He cannot escape it. So if a certain philosophy reigns in the universities without opposition, that is what will govern all the men within its range. And you can, therefore, find philosophy in the real world out there wherever you look. You can find the very philosophy that rules the profession in the universities. And just as it is wrecking the profession, so it is wrecking the real world. Let's take a look. Primitive man has art and religion, but he has no science. Science is a distinctively rational endeavor. Modern science arose with the Renaissance, the rebirth of reason, and it is the root of the modern industrial world. If and when science goes, civilization goes with it. Is it going? Well, here's a little evidence. A recent issue of the Los Angeles Times headlined the following question over a book review. Are the laws of physics inventions or reality? Of course, you know what the Kantian answer is. The book being reviewed is called Inventing Reality. It is not by a philosopher, but by a prominent scientist, Bruce Gregory of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Here's a little quote from him. Quote, a physicist is no more engaged in painting a realistic picture of the world than a realistic painter is. Physical theories do not tell physicists how the world is. There is little evidence that we have any idea of what reality looks like from some absolute point of view. We know only what the world looks like from our point of view, unquote. That, of course, is absolute pure Kant. If a plumber came into your home to fix a leak and introduced himself by saying, hi, I'm out of contact with reality and have no idea what it looks like, but don't worry because I invent it as I go along, you would probably be alarmed. Since by his own statement, reality exercises no restraint over him, he is capable of inventing or destroying anything. The same is true of physicists who say the same thing. They like to invent and destroy, particularly destroy. There are no lengths they will not go to in order to demonstrate their alleged metaphysical power. Science in this approach becomes a grab for power, a game of how much can I get away with? How blatant a fact can I deny? After all, I'm the inventor of reality. Now here's a taste of what I mean. Thankfully, there's not enough time for a whole banquet. This is from a column by Malcolm Brown, who is a highly respected science writer for the New York Times. This column is entitled, Reality, a Grand Illusion? ? And here's the opening sentence. Ever thought of escaping the ugliness of rush hour subway rides by convincing yourself that subways are illusions with no real existence? Science, you know, he means the IRT and the BMT. Science, he goes on, quote, has provided some new insights, suggesting that neither subways nor their human riders are as real as we naturally suppose, unquote. Now then, he proceeds to rattle off various theories, including quantum mechanics, allegedly to justify this conclusion. The details are irrelevant for our purposes. I want you to see the blatancy here. This is not some woolly-headed philosopher uttering floating generalities about reality at a convention of academics. Here is a respected science writer saying flat out, we have reason to question whether subways are real. And he is in the mainstream while doing it. He is regarded not as a maniac, but as a witty au courant. Now, where do you think science of this kind is going to end up? Science rests on facts. When subways are no longer real, there are no facts. So anything goes. Do you remember the good old days when there was a contrast between religion and science? Religion, for instance, preached myths about creation ex nihilo. Science took reality as eternal and described its laws, one of which was that you can't get something out of nothing. Well, here's the last paragraph of the Brown piece. Quote, "One bewildering outcome of quantum theory has led some scientists to speculate that the entire universe, including the time in which it exists, may have been created by a spontaneous quantum fluctuation, a twitch in the nothingness that preceded it. Could a twitch in the opposite direction convert the universe back into non-existence? With such a twitch, all memory and trace of subway riders and universe would be gone." Unquote. Now, I submit that this is lower than traditional religion. Try walking around with the feeling that an apocalyptic twitch is imminent, which will annihilate everything causelessly and reinstate eternal nothingness. And then remember that this is the sort of stuff being preached by the most rational segment left of our society in the most advanced science, physics. Now let's sample a different aspect of the world out there, the humanities, specifically literary criticism. Do you think the English professors are recommending objective thought to their students? Well, of course, not if you remember Kant, you don't. If there is no reality, there can be no objective thought. Objectivity means conformity to the object of thought. And in a Kantian age, the object is whatever the subject decrees it to be. Objectivity, therefore, is out of the question and out the window. All we have is competing subjectivities. I or my group make the object whatever I want it to be. You and your group do likewise. As to what the object really is, it isn't anything. It has no nature apart from our interpretation. In itself, it is indeterminate. After all, there is no reality. One well-publicized example of this approach today is the theory called deconstruction in literary criticism. It's widely publicized precisely because it carries out brazenly, without shame or cover-up, the trend ruling all the humanities. In essence, deconstruction holds that the meaning of any text, such as an essay, a poem, a treatise, a novel, is indeterminate. If you say the cat is on the mat, that is indeterminate. There is no way to interpret it objectively. If you reply, but I know what I mean, I have a definite intent here. I am making a statement about the position of a certain animal. The deconstructionists brush you away. After all, they insist, and here I quote from a writer to the Times, quote, "There is no such thing as a single intent. We have multiple and often contradictory intentions regarding any act, including the act of producing meaning," unquote. So you see, maybe cat and mat also have hidden Freudian significance to you. Maybe cat in your unconscious means male, and mat means female, so you don't even know what you mean. But that's just the beginning. There's another deeper reason why your intent is irrelevant. Can you guess? You couldn't guess this unless you took it in class. I quote the same letter writer. According to deconstruction, an author's intent is irrelevant to the meaning of a text because there is no such thing as an author. Did you get that? There's no such thing as an author. How do they get that? Quote, "The concept of author presupposes a unified human subject who controls language," unquote. You see, we know, being Kantians, that we don't control language. Language controls us. In other words, our categories create the world we live in, including the fiction of unified human individuals. Well, where then, you might ask, do texts come from, since not from authors? Quote, texts are not the products of an individual will, but instead represent the intersection of competing cultural codes. Unquote. How did we get to have a culture without any individual? Don't ask. Just observe that there is no reality, there are no subways, there are no authors. How then are we to interpret any text if meaning is indeterminate and author is a myth? For that matter, how are we to know how to interpret the text of any law passed by our government? How are we to know how to interpret the principles of our institutions? How are we to know what any of our words or ideas on any subject mean? Which ones, if any, are right, which are wrong? What theory can we use to guide us for these purposes? Obviously, we're helpless. There are no objective answers. Kant established that. One member of this school, Stanley Fish, tells us that we shouldn't worry, though. We should simply, quote, do what comes naturally. In other words, count on assumptions built into us by nature, assumptions outside our power of choice or thought. Thinking, he suggests, is really a waste of time. Looking for some theoretical basis to justify what we do or like or hate is a mistake. Who needs theory? And here is the climactic sentence from a complimentary review of Mr. Fish's latest book, which is called Doing What Comes Naturally. Listen to this one. This was put in a big box by the review as the main point of the thing. Mr. Fish's principal theoretical point is that there can be no such thing as theory. Unquote. There are no subways, no authors, no theory, no nothing. Now, if you're starting to feel a bit queasy, we can turn to modern psychology for a bout of Kantian psychotherapy. Under the heading of mental health, a few years ago, the New York Times ran a survey on recent developments under this headline, "Trying to face reality, it may be the last thing that the doctor orders." Well, I thought, if reality doesn't exist, and you can't know it even if it did, obviously you shouldn't be trying to face it. But I wondered, how are they going to put this one over? And here is how, quote, the evidence, notice they always appeal to science, quote, the evidence seriously questions the belief that facing reality is a hallmark of mental health. Instead, it suggests that within limits, living a life of illusion is normal and healthy. The healthy illusions include an unrealistically positive view of oneself, an exaggerated sense of control, and an unfounded optimism. Unquote. Now, the translation of this is that Augustine was right. In other words, man is sordid and crooked, be spotted and ulcerous. Any positive view that you have of yourself, therefore, has to be unrealistic because man is rotten. Any sense of control you have is exaggerated because man is helpless. And any optimism you have is unfounded because life is hell. But we need some kind of hope and self-esteem, so let's lie to ourselves. That's how they make it plausible. But what is these theorists' deeper meaning and purpose? To bring psychotherapy fully into the Kantian fold. To establish the principle that reality is as dispensable in psychology as it is in physics. To give a patient license to escape into any fantasy or delusion he wishes, so long as he has the blessing of his analyst at 300 per hour. The analyst who now replaces reality as the ultimate arbiter and standard of reference. There are no subways, said the avant-garde physicist, to which his analytic sidekick adds, and it would make you sick if you faced them. Anyway, just listen to me instead. You see that when reality is gone, some kind of dictator always appears to take over its function in human life and tell us what to do. Now, the author of this article would accuse me of being unfair because he also writes the following. So listen to this for accuracy. Quote, "To be sure, there are limits to how far one can cling to illusion. The old clinical wisdom that reality, no matter how bitter, was needed for mental health was grounded to a large extent on work with people who were grossly out of touch. For such people, stronger contact with reality is needed. But for the majority of people who do not suffer a severe mental disorder, there is a more moderate range of illusion that seems to be essential." Unquote. Translation, it's okay to break with reality, but only until it makes you really sick. Now, you see the skepticism here, the profound rejection of any absolutes, even of their own basic premises. There are no absolutes, no extremes, no principles. That's the essential theme of all the modernists. There's no reality, maybe, partly, some of the time. And you can't know it? Probably. And you shouldn't face it, except when you should, if you feel like it. And you don't get too grossly out of touch, as determined by who? How? Don't ask. Now, I have to apologize to St. Augustine for making it sound as though he had a low view of man. And because Augustine, after all, granted some validity to the human mind, and therefore some value to human beings. He is a positive man glorifier compared to the Kantians, who reject the mind wholesale and therefore hate humanity without limits or restraint. Is this an exaggeration on my part? Here is the first paragraph of a review of a book just a few months old called Green Rage, written by an environmentalist who belongs to a group called Earth First. This is all the following is from the review. He starts by quoting Mary McCarthy and then goes on from there. In one of her works, Mary McCarthy chronicled the birth of the Renaissance and wrote of the feeling that a terrible mistake was committed here. A mistake that had to do with power and megalomania or gigantism of the human ego. She cites the cold, vain stare of Michelangelo's David, in love with his own strength and beauty. The members of the environmental group Earth First would sympathize with Ms. McCarthy's feeling. However, they would date the megalomaniacal mistake earlier, at the very beginning of civilization. Indeed, one of the slogans of Earth First is back to the Pleistocene. Unquote. The Renaissance was a mistake. The David, which is the great all-time projection of man as a hero, is a perversion. Civilization is megalomania. How then is man to live? How is he to survive? Well, one of the environmentalists in this movement gives the answer. He describes human beings as, quote, a cancer on nature, and he adds, quote, I am the antibody, unquote. Now, Augustine is a benevolent humanist by comparison. The alleged scientific basis of environmentalism is a myth. Its alleged concern for human well-being is a big lie. The essence of this movement is precisely what one would have to expect at the climax of the anti-reality, anti-reason viewpoint. The essence is worse than the advocacy of a finite number of murders. It's the rejection of human life as such. There are no subways, there is no theory, and there should be no man. Now, what do you think this does to the sense of life of a culture? I'm speaking not just of environmentalism, but of the philosophy at its root, which permeates all our endeavors and institutions. What does it do to people's sense of values, of the human potential, of hope for the future? Well, the Orange County Register, a while back, gave a very instructive answer. by discussing, of all things, a new breed of comic book with huge sales, not only among teens, but also among young adults. And the Register titled his piece, Comics for the Apocalypse. Quote, what is different about the new books, the paper says, is the unremittingly grim and cynical tone. These characters inhabit a moral shadow land without absolutes of right and wrong. Unquote. One scholar, obviously Kantian, comments approvingly that these new comics, quote, are driven by some dark truths. They know that the world is not black and white. Now, do you want an example of a non-black and white comic? Here is the Register's summary of one highly popular comic now on the market called The Dark Knight, capital N. Ask yourself whether you would like your child to be raised on stories like this and what would happen to him if this was all he could find to read. Quote, it answers the question, what happens when Batman gets old and realizes he spent his whole life fighting crime and crime won? Batman decides no more Mr. Nice Guy and ends up a fugitive hounded by the news media who accuse him of being a psychotic vigilante preying on poor misunderstood killers. Unquote. Now, at this point, someone may object that I'm supposed to be talking not about comics or science, but about the real world out there, the real world. In other words, not culture or colleges, but business and above all, politics, practical politics, the kind on the front pages of all the newspapers. So let's take that as the final challenge. What has philosophy, specifically Kant's philosophy, got to do with that particular world? A few years ago, I got a letter from an objectivist in South Carolina who worked for a radio station. His station had hired a firm of consultants who had written a long memo outlining the policies the station should follow in order to raise its ratings. The manager of the station, according to my correspondent, thought the memo was so important that he passed it to everyone on the staff to read and sign. This memo states Kant's ideas. It states them straight, without any cover-up or coyness, exactly as an unphilosophical businessman and politician understand them and act on them. Now, hear this memo, or at least one page from it, and project what it means and has to mean in practice. In anyone's practice, whether a radio station manager or a TV network head or the head of an entire nation. The memo deals with listener perception. Quote, the critical point we need to keep in mind is that in the final analysis, the perception is the reality. The tastes, desires, and preferences of the listener are what's important. Whatever the listener thinks is right, even if it isn't. This is true even when emotion overrules logic, which is often the case. In the real world, reason thought often takes a back seat to sentiment. As they say, feelings are facts. Whether we like it or not, we need to understand and accept the basic truth that perception, like beauty, rests in the eyes of the beholder. For us in radio, this means creating a radio station that is good according to the tastes and perceptions of listeners. And perception doesn't refer to truth. Perception is a mental image that listeners develop. Often this image is in direct conflict with what the truth may actually be. What truth is what listeners think truth is, and that is all that matters. Unquote. Now, I don't think anything could be more explicit than that. Perception is the reality. That's Kant's critique of pure reason. Reason has to take a backseat to feelings. That's Kant's critique of practical reason. Conclusion, whatever people want is true, even if it isn't. Now you say, how can they make a statement it's true even if it isn't? Because they would come back to you and say, who can say it isn't? Who can say what is? There is no reality. There's no absolutes. There's no objectivity. There's no right and wrong. There's no basis to criticize anybody. There's only people's arbitrary desires. So if you want something from people, that's where you start, with their arbitrary desires or views. This doesn't matter whether it's their listeners, voters, pressure groups, the other political party, foreign allies. You just have to remember, whatever people think is right, even if it isn't. Do they want something unreasonable on purely emotional grounds? Well, as the memo says, feelings are facts, and perception lies in the eye of the beholder. So who is to say what's a fact? If you succeed and achieve your goal with people by whatever means, great, the strategy worked. If not, switch your viewpoint. There are no absolutes. Turn to some different people. Remember that whatever they think is right, even if it isn't. And try again. Now, you know, of course, the name of this policy is pragmatism. And philosophically, it's a minor offshoot of Kant. Now, the result of following this approach will be utter unpredictability. You have no long-range policy, no coherence from day to day, no grand vision controlling your course, just erratic jumps as you try to appease warring groups with momentary compromises that fall apart as soon as you make them. You're willing to keep changing your mind in this view. You're eager to do so because rigidity, in quotes, is a crime. Of course, you can claim absolutes, but only as a bargaining chip of the moment. In other words, only as long as it really isn't an absolute. Nothing is more important than keeping all your groups, whether they're logical, rational, or irrational. You have to keep them all going, all flexible, adaptable, and playing the game by whatever means is necessary. So if you're a Republican president, to synopsize, you say, no new taxes, read my lips. That'll win the election. Sorry. New taxes, folks. I have to satisfy the Democrats. But no rise in income tax rates. Absolutely not. Have to keep the Senate Republicans happy. Okay, we'll have a rise in the rates, but only if the capital gain taxes are lowered. All right, don't lower them. Soak the rich this time, but absolutely no new taxes the next time. Or in foreign policy, Iraq is the enemy because of its grab for oil. No, that sounds too selfish. Economic, it doesn't play well. We better drop that. Iraq is the enemy because of its naked aggression. Much better. Of course, it's not our mission to be the world's policeman. Well, then, Iraq is the enemy because Saddam Hussein is worse than Hitler. He isn't? Well, then, it's because of jobs that we have to fight Iraq. Fight Iraq? What do you mean? There's only a blockade, only economic sanctions. We have unlimited patience. A few weeks ago, months ago, we were being told this. We may wait there in the sand for years, and we'll rotate our troops, but Iraq somehow doesn't seem to believe us. So let's throw in a few hundred thousand more men and a policy of no rotation. We're getting ready for war. Saddam Hussein, you better believe it and give in. No, of course not, dear congressmen and Soviet allies. We have no thought of war. We're merely playing poker with 500,000 men. We're not actually going to use them, etc. Now, you know all the flip-flops in domestic and foreign policy just as well as I do. We all read the same papers. The point is not that Mr. Bush changes his mind a lot or that he hasn't thought through his ideas. Would that that were the problem. The point is that he has no ideas, not in the old-fashioned sense of definite convictions, and that he regards this as a virtue. He has no uncompromised principles. He has no ideas on taxes, on the budget, and in my opinion, no idea whether he wants to go to war with Iraq or not. To him, ideas are passé. There are no absolutes, as he sees it. No one can say what's right. Who knows what the real truth is? All he knows is whatever people think is right, even when it's wrong, for the moment. Now, Mr. Bush all but confessed this at one point just before the election. He was apologizing for having caved into the Democrats, and he explained repeatedly that he had to place the welfare of society first above his own economic principles. Now, just think of that as an idea. If his principles are true, if more investment and lower taxes are really essential to the welfare of the country, and he'd been insisting on that for years, how could the welfare of the country demand his sacrifice of these principles? Shouldn't he have hung on to the end, fighting for the truth and thus the country? And of course, the answer is if your principles are not based on reality, they have no conviction for you. And in the Kantian pragmatist viewpoint, nobody's principles are based on reality. There is no reality for them to be based on. Who knows what's the truth, therefore? Who knows what to do? Who knows what's right? We're caught in a nightmare without guidelines or understanding, and we grab at anything that will get us to the next point with no idea what comes after that. Now, one Republican, I underscore Republican consultant, was quoted in the Times during the budget crisis as follows, quote, "The White House has just been floating without any strong ties to causes or issues or philosophy. George Bush doesn't understand people who really believe and are really committed and who don't want to compromise on principles in the budget process because he is the ultimate pragmatist who just wants to make government work," unquote. You see how well it's working by his method. Now observe that Mr. Bush is said to have no strong ties to philosophy, which in a sense is obviously true. And yet, on a deeper level, it's completely untrue. Mr. Bush is the product, the culmination of a very definite philosophy. Now, I grant you that politicians have contradicted themselves through the ages, and that you can't blame Kant for all of them. But some kind of philosophy does lie behind every kind of ruler through the ages. And the particular characteristics of our leaders, their righteous lack of principle, their worship of flexibility, their inability to sustain any long-range course, or even to preach the same ideas for 2 weeks at a time, their brazen insistence that no one knows anything or can, all of this is distinctly modern, distinctively 20th century. It would have been impossible as the norm in the ancient world or the medieval or the early modern period. It is distinctively Kantian. So if the real world out there means the political world, then philosophy does shape the real world out there. One kind of philosophy leads to one kind of age, another to its opposite. Now I have a piece of good news. Despite all that I've said, despite his omnipresence in our world, Kant as a power in the West is now dead. And you can see the signs of his demise everywhere. Kant is dead in academic philosophy. The subject has effectively expired under his tutelage. It's lost its students, its prestige, its subject matter. That's where we started this evening with the collapse of philosophy. Kant is dead among the intellectuals in general. Their official view now is not any philosophy, but disillusionment. They call it the end of ideology. Kant is dead in the realm of art, where nihilism has little left to defy and is turning into its inevitable product, nihil, nothing. They call that minimalism now. Kant is dead even in Berlin and Moscow. World communism, as you know, which Kant's disciples Hegel and Marx created, is now disintegrating. Wherever you look, you see the signs of Kant's influence and the signs of his death. Which is the real truth? Well, my answer is both. His disciples are everywhere, but his time is up. The collapse of a negative is not a positive. The atrophy of a vicious version of unreason is not the adoption of reason. If men fail to discover living ideas, they will keep moving by the guidance of dead ones, as they are doing today. They will keep following, by inertia, the principles they have already institutionalized. For the nations of East and West alike today, no matter what the faddish lip service to a free market, the culmination of these principles is some variant of dictatorship. If not communist, then fascist, and or religious, and or tribal. Force and faith on such a scale would mean the fate of the ancients over again. The only man who can stave off another dark ages is the man who ended them the last time, Aristotle, the father of the Enlightenment and of the United States. Is there a chance for the forces of reason to win this late in the game? Well, I'd have to say, if one judges by precedent, no. We are arguably far past the point of no return. The idea of a philosophic revolution in America, in other words, a revolution of the intellectuals and the leadership back to reason and reality, that's probably the merest fantasy. However, America is a country without precedent, to which precedent may not be applicable, and man has the faculty of volition. To the end of her life, Ayn Rand upheld her distinctive benevolent universe premise, as she called it. The good she maintained can be achieved. Remember from Atlas Shrugged, she said, it is real, it's possible, it's yours. So long as there's no censorship, she taught, there is a chance for persuasion to succeed. If no definite prediction can be made, she taught, then in reason only one action is proper, to go on fighting for reason. Let's do it together. Thank you.
Thank you. This is the opportunity for our audience to ask questions. If those of you who wish to ask questions would come to either of the two microphones at the front of the two aisles, I will call upon you alternating between the aisles. I would ask you to please speak clearly and briefly, and to remember that you are asking questions and that it is Dr. Peikoff who will enlighten us with the answers. So if you...
What would be the proper response of President Bush to Saddam's proposal to release the hostages in exchange for withdrawal of American troops?
Do you want me to repeat that?
Well, the question is, what would be the proper response for President Bush to Saddam Hussein's offer to release the hostages in return for the withdrawal of American troops?
He should not, absolutely not do it. Just a comment on Iraq. I don't want to make the entire thing foreign policy, but I believe that war is unavoidable at this juncture, and advisable, strongly necessary and advisable for several reasons. I think it's a tragedy that the West has gotten itself to the point where such a war is necessary, partly by having built up the Iraqi regime, and partly by being so craven in regard to oil. All of the oil in the Mideast is discovered by Westerners, was made possible by Western technology, is processed by Western equipment and Western expertise. I do not recognize the moral right of any of those desert regimes to any of that oil. I regard that as, properly speaking, the property of the discoverers and the creators. And I think that to have discovered that oil, let it be nationalized, let a civilization run on it, and then be held hostage to any dictator in perpetuity is a fantastic abdication. The West has every right and every moral right to reclaim all, not simply from Iraq, but all of the oil fields, and to do it as a moral principle of reclaiming private property and everything that that stands for, namely the creative mind that made it possible, because when it was simply roving tribes on the desert, it was not property or of any value. It was slime under the earth. So from that point of view, I abhor the people who say you shouldn't, blood is more important than oil. I mean, by that argument, you could just as well say let Iraqis invade Massachusetts, and it's just earth. Blood is more important than dirt. Something of that kind is not something that a civilization that expects to survive can give away. Now, I grant you that the West is in a very anomalous position in that regard, because they would be put in a very difficult position to claim their oil abroad while expropriating the owners in this country. They don't believe in private property here in the United States. So, of course, their hands are tied, and that's why they don't dare say anything about oil publicly. But further, we wouldn't even be as dependent, and according to some sources, we wouldn't be dependent at all on Mideast oil if there weren't all the ecological restrictions that tie the hands of the oil industry here and make exploration and development of alternative energy sources impossible on all fronts, from nuclear energy and so on. So that if they had a decent domestic policy, if we got the ecological movement out and private property back in, the oil situation would not be what it is. But unfortunately, it is what it is. And America has absolutely every right and apparently necessity to claim that oil, not simply to drop the price of gas 10 cents, but in order to establish the principle of its control over this oil. Not that you can trust the politicians to do that, because otherwise they're simply going to seize one. You know, Saudi Arabia was almost taken over, and the next, and then the screws will be tightened. That's one reason why I definitely believe the war is necessary. The hostages is another reason. Any country that allows hostages to be taken and that does not immediately declare war is going to face a succession of disasters. And the reason for the Iraqi disaster is because of the way the Iranian crisis was handled under Carter, etc., where they just turned the other way. And after Iran, after Lebanon, well, anybody feels they can take thousands of Americans and all that's going to happen is, quote, negotiation. So all American sovereignty is gone. And it's just a paper tiger. So I understand that war might kill many of the hostages. That doesn't alter the fact there is nothing else we can do. You try not to drop the bombs where you know they are, and if they had gone to war right away, as was being urged by certain people like William Safire, before they had deployed the hostages, you know, as the human shield, they were telling them at the time, do it right now before they get deployed. But of course, we had to go through the United Nations, which is also a mockery, because the mockery of going through the United Nations amounts to saying the United States is not a sovereign country. We are not allowed to take a foreign policy action on our own initiative to defend our interests. It doesn't make any difference if we are being strangled and our citizens are being held hostage. We have to, first of all, make a deal with the Minister of China to turn away for the next massacre, and make a deal with Gorbachev to arrange that Saudi Arabia gives him $1 billion worth of food to get communism through the next winter, you know, and all the other back deals. We have to do all that first so that now we can have the, quote, assembled world opinion behind this use of force. That is simply abrogation. Bush's idea of a new world order is abrogation of American sovereignty. He's telling us we can no longer assert our own interests without a vote, which we have to now horse trade. Those are a few points. I wanted to add one other thing. There's another major reason why I think war is essential, and that is because of Hussein's buildup of biological, chemical, and potentially nuclear weapons. This guy has got a million people on his head, a million victims. He's used these weapons on the Kurds. He's obviously got no compunction whatever about using nuclear weapon, which he's working feverishly to get. In the face of that kind of threat, you cannot possibly say, well, let the next administration worry about it. He's obviously going to go after the Middle East, and then what's going to happen is America will have to go to war with him when he's got nuclear weapons. Now, people are worried, and reasonably so, about nuclear proliferation. The best way to let Pakistan and every other country that you're worried about know not to use their weapons is to absolutely annihilate Baghdad. If that is simply razed to the ground, you wouldn't have to worry about the New World Order, and you wouldn't have to worry about any further messages or treaties or discussions. That would be the end. Now, I just want to, and I know this is not the subject, but I read these papers and have apoplexy. I strongly disapprove of a ground war. I think it would be a nightmare insanity to take hundreds of thousands of American boys and march them into the Kuwait and try to dislodge the Iraqis, by that means. It would be massive American casualties for no purpose. I don't see any reason in the world why we should be concerned with saving Kuwait. Kuwait is, a modest dictatorship. Certainly, if somebody wants to save it, that has to be on a volunteer basis. It can't be by American taxpayers' money. But what should be done is a massive air assault on Baghdad, on all of the military and industrial, with the idea of taking what they used to say decades ago, take it back to the Stone Age. And if that were done, it would be a revolution. But unfortunately, I very much fear, I'm in real fear of what will happen on January 15th, because I don't believe anybody knows, including our highest planners, what they're going to do on January 15th, or whether, they'll go to war, make another deal, have another resolution, or take 6 months off while they celebrate, an Islamic holiday, or decide that the snow has come too soon, who knows what's going to happen? And having built up this kind of force there, if nothing is done or if a compromise is made, then the consequences will be disastrous for the American position in the world. Truly disastrous.
Excuse me.
Is that
excuse
answer
me.
The question?
It's the same question.
No, excuse me. There are other people. Thank you. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to go on so long.
Yes. Isn't the benevolent universe premise you closed your talk with a quaint illusion of the sort you railed against in your section on psychology?
Do you have to repeat it or not?
No.
All right. No, it's not, because you're misdefining benevolent universe premise. Benevolent universe premise does not say the universe is benevolent. The benevolent universe premise says that if you hold rational values, they can be achieved. That the universe is open to the achievement of rational values. Doesn't say how soon or how quickly or how long. That's not the same as saying that the universe guarantees the solution. A promise is the solution. It's not the same as a belief in God. I cover that in the book.
Professor Peikoff, did the assassination of Rabbi Meir Kahane possibly portend the Rashidization of America that you spoke about 2 years earlier? And do you expect to see a spate of assassinations for, like, pro-Israel viewpoints or maybe even abortion viewpoints?
I don't know. I didn't follow the Kahane assassination, so I have no views on who did it or what it signified. And just an assassination per se doesn't prove anything unless you know who did it or what the motive was or what the climate was. So I can't answer that. Seems to me that all I've been reading for as long back as I can remember is what the income tax rate is and how we're going to have war with Iraq. That's the only two things in the New York Times.
Set. Now I've been told that there's growing interest in realism and Aristotelianism and philosophy, that there's a vital movement within Austrian economics that seems to be growing, that there's a number of popular books that denounce deconstructionism and humanities departments in general. So aren't these signs that positive is in fact occurring, as well as the destruction of a negative?
If they're true, but I don't know them of my own firsthand knowledge. Yeah. But I know that there would be a lot of things attacking deconstruction, because everything bad is attacked by things that are worse. But as far as what's being upheld, who is upholding Aristotle and to what extent, I don't know. If there is a movement toward upholding him, that's good. It hasn't reached the sphere out in California where I observe.
About 2 years ago in Pittsburgh, Vartan Gregorian, who was then or perhaps now is the president of Brown University, was asked the question what he thought about the solutions to the education problem were. And his answer to this woman was, "I'm not interested in causes. You can argue over causes. This is a national phenomenon, and about the only thing I can see to be done is what people are doing now, this and that, and that's all you can hope for." And that's verbatim. Could you care to comment on that?
On that
attitude? Is that common in education?
But with the attitude of he's not interested in the causes of bad education?
Right.
It?
Because you can argue over the causes.
Yeah. Well, that's a very common attitude, not only in education, but in all fields. And it is a perfectly skeptical attitude. In other words, it's the attitude, well, what's the point of saying what got us here? Because all kinds of people are going to disagree. So a pragmatist doesn't care how you got where you are. He wants to know, where do we go from here? Wherever we are now, that's simply the given. The whole essence of pragmatism is out-of-context action. In other words, wherever we are, that's it. What caused the problem, who knows? That's, you know, antiquarian. It's past. We're here. And that's, of course, what all politicians say, too, now. You know, don't tell me, if you talk to them, they'll say, don't tell me about what the progressive movement and the New Deal and so on. It's too late. We're here now. Where do we go from here, you see? And he's saying basically the same thing. There's no use discussing it. As a purely pragmatic attitude, and the trouble with it is that you never can find out where to go or cure the problem because you don't know the cause. Now, the ultimate example of that was at this APA symposium. Glidden criticized my paper, which was, you know, similar to the one I've given here, in the sense of making Kant the cause, and he said in his comments that he didn't want to get into philosophy in this discussion because there's so much disagreement. He just wanted to get into, you know, what's wrong with philosophers today on that narrow descriptive level. But once you start with the history of philosophy and what led to it, well, everybody could have his own theory, and then we're not going to have any agreement. Well, that's exactly the same thing, and it's hopeless. You just may as well give up. Be like a doctor saying, "I don't know how you got here, I'm just going to cure you. I don't know what the cause is, but I'll try this medicine. If not, you die, okay, I'll try something else and somebody else."
I want to know what the objector's viewpoint is on mandatory jury duties, and should there be a voluntary one, and if would it work in large cities? If not, what is the alternative?
Well, that is a technical question for such an unforeseeably far future that I can't say a great deal has been done with regard to that. I don't think that that would be a problem particularly. I don't myself see why that would have to be mandatory, because if you were paid a decent fee and you didn't have to spend your entire time, you know, sitting around the jury room wasting time, right? I think there would be volunteers to do it.
It's mandatory right now.
Yeah. Oh, it's mandatory right now. Yeah. But I'm not in a position to say whether that is necessarily wrong. There are certain things which are inherent in the possibility of a legal system which you can justify as compulsory if you can show that the alternative would be the legal system is impossible. Then anybody who wants the benefit would have to take part, would have to accept that particular thing. Now, for instance, the power of subpoena. And it's been argued and validly, as far as I can make out, that that would be necessary to make a legal system operate. And that if you have the choice not to join, but if you want the benefits, you have to agree to submit to that. So it's a question of whether jury duty would be in that category or not. I think it should keep that category to the bare minimum. And anything where money would do rather than compulsion, I would certainly say money. And I don't see why you couldn't get a perfectly good jury simply by paying people for their time. But I'm not a philosopher of law.
In your talk this evening, you spoke disparagingly of the medieval scholastics. And yet I know that both you and Ms. Rand had much respect for Thomas Aquinas and admiration for him. My question is, did you mean to include him in those scholastics that you spoke of disparagingly? And B, in your opinion, on a deeper level, how did someone like Thomas Aquinas, a towering intellect, a great logician, go wrong? Where and how?
Wow. Well, first of all, Aquinas is a scholastic. But if you notice, I was not scathing in my denunciation of the scholastics by any means, not the medieval scholastics. I disapproved of their withdrawal from life, but Aquinas was the one who reintroduced the importance of this world and this life. So he's a transition. He dug the grave of scholasticism. He was the one who turned it around and who brought an end to the medieval period. So I can say I denounce the medieval period, but that doesn't mean I have to denounce Aquinas, because he's the medieval who brought the medievals to an end. Now, if you say, where did Aquinas go wrong? It's an unhistorical question. The better question is, how did he do as right as he did? Here's a man in a complete vacuum. With Aristotle had just been discovered, throwing all the religions of the world, into chaos. And he had only really Moses Maimonides as a guide, who tried to say, how can you reconcile Aristotle with Judaism? Before Aquinas, there was just the Alexander the Great Albert the Great had produced Aristotle, made it known, and the question was, now what are you going to do with it? And everybody's instinct was, this is the mortal threat, this is the enemy. They couldn't conceive that they were wrong. This, you have to try to remember, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years when no other thought was ever recorded or even imagined. And to be able, in the face of that, to grasp truthfully the essence of a pagan viewpoint such as Aristotle's, and try to integrate the two, is such a feat of genius. I would never for a minute think that more was possible. I would say if anybody at that period, in that context, had said, okay, down with the Bible, I'm going to go by, Aristotle's logic, I would say that is humanly impossible. You couldn't switch that gigantic a context that, you know, that much. Aquinas did more than you could even imagine. So that's my answer.
I would like to know, is there anyone in politics today that you would advocate for the next presidential election?
Is there anyone that Dr. Peikoff would support in the next presidential election?
I couldn't say at this time. There are one or two people that I do not cringe when I watch. But I don't know at what point I would, or what would happen to them if they ran, because I've seen so many who sounded decent until they got a national platform, and then they just went to pieces, that right now there's just nobody that I would...
Those few people are...
I'd rather not say. For their sake, too, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you'd comment on the sentencing of Mike Milken.
You know, I did not follow that case at all, but given that I didn't, the little that I read, it seemed like an atrocity to me. It sounded like he was being attacked, denounced, and given this horrendous, unprecedented sentence because he was extremely wealthy and had come up with this creative method of financing, which they derogate as junk bonds. Apparently, he made many major industrial enterprises possible, and he was a real financial genius. Now, you know, I don't believe in insider trading at all. I don't think there should be any laws against insider trading. I think that whole thing is a corrupt, undefinable, non-objective government intervention. So the only question I don't know is, did he actually do something that I would regard as fraudulent? I never saw any evidence that he did. I know also that the prosecutors were making every kind of threat imaginable and brought the whole weight of the federal government down, and it smacked of coercive intimidation and of a scapegoat. But unfortunately, I can't, you know, I didn't research that, and I'm not a banker or economist. But if my impression is correct, that is a monstrous miscarriage of justice. Even if he gets only one third of the 10 years.
What advice would you have for an objectivist who's planning on becoming an educator, in light of the fact that irrationality is advocated so much in our education system?
An educator at what level?
College.
Oh, you're going to teach at college?
It'll be a few years.
And the only advice I could give you is try to survive. I mean, you have to get your degree.
But I mean, like, I would think that such a teacher with such views might have a hard time holding a job.
Well, first of all, you'd have a hard time getting a job. But that depends also what field you're in. What field do you want to teach?
English.
That's pretty hard. I have no really good advice. All I can do is tell you, learn the field, try to be reasonable, try to show your potential employer that you possess skills, try to find the common ground of interest, in other words, between the skills they want and the things that you actually regard are skills, and try to demonstrate those to them. Don't lie about your views, and on the other hand, it is not necessary at each job interview to go up and tell the person every controversial thing that you believe. You wait sometimes to the second interview or the third. That's all I can say, right?
Just the questioners that are standing. Go ahead.
I have a question as to what do you think literal and figurative mean? The two terms, literal and figurative?
What has that got to do with me?
I'm just curious, as an objectivist, what you believe literal and figurative to mean.
That is not an objectivist distinction.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize. How's that?
I mean, it's just an ordinary English. You've got to look it up in the dictionary.
Oh, okay. Well, let me change my direction of question then. If you take objectivism, or as I've been taking it, trying to go to the logical extreme,
right?
You know, take it to its full logical conclusion of objectivism, it seems to negate the subject.
How?
Well, if you were to be purely objective, you would have to lose all subjectivity, and if you lost all subjectivity, you would be no subject to have objectivity.
Wait a minute. You are just playing with language there.
Oh, I'm sorry then.
Let me answer. If you say if you're purely objective, you have to negate the subject. But what the subjectivity? What is the subjectivity you're talking about? The subject objectivity is the subject focusing on the object.
Okay.
Using logic, right, and then reacting emotionally. So if that's the subject, its processes and its emotional reactions are all still there. It's not as though you say, I only perceive, but I don't evaluate, and I don't react, and there is no me. You are the one doing the perceiving, doing the evaluating, and doing the reacting, and all of that is an unavoidable consequence of your objective process. So if you attach meanings to words, objectivity presupposes the subject and all of the subject's responses. Why do you feel that if you're completely objective, there's no subject? You're just making...
Well, it would appear that to be completely objective, you wouldn't be putting any of your beliefs into an understanding.
So no, not until they're validated.
So
you would put your beliefs into your understanding of the next point once you've grasped the first point. In other words, objectivity doesn't mean starting each question as though you're a newborn baby with an empty consciousness. Objectivity means starting the first question that way, coming to a conclusion that's based on the object, and then using that to help you get to the next, and then that to get to the next, and so on. So when I, for instance, now come to read the newspaper, I bring in a tremendous philosophic context, and I regard myself as being objective. My mind is not empty, but I bring a whole philosophic context, but each one of those, in turn, I can take back all the way, ultimately, to direct observation.
But you could never negate subjectivity, then.
What is subjectivity?
Well, that's my question, in essence.
Well, if you don't know what it is, how do you know whether you can negate it?
Well, subjectivity, to me, would be applying the subject of your personal beliefs to anything which you are observing.
I'm sorry, I just answered that. I answered exactly that. You can apply your personal beliefs as long as they're more than personal, but also logical. And if they're not logical, they shouldn't be your personal beliefs. You should drop them and get other personal beliefs.
The Supreme Court has more and more failed to protect individual property rights. Such as rent control and zoning. What is your outlook for the individual's pursuit of property rights and the protection of that?
Of the Supreme Court?
For the nation.
You mean, what is my outlook for property rights or for the Supreme Court?
For the defense of those rights in the Supreme Court.
I don't have any particular predictions about the Supreme Court, and I don't see that there's going to be much hope of decent appointments to it. I think it's really excellent that Bork was not appointed to it. But I don't know that field particularly. I don't know anybody that I would advocate to be appointed to it. I just don't follow it that close.
Dr. Peikoff, on behalf of the Ford Hall Forum, and I'm sure on behalf of the audience, we thank you very, very much.